just landed in jail. Look out, boys, they come down fast. Baby addiction of the wicked class. In your heart or in your home, never have to be alone. Woman doors and wild attack, anything to catch a rest. We ain't got no faith.
That's right, you are listening to Stark Raven, Vancouver's only show that focuses on news in Canadian prisons.
My name is Emily Aspinwall.
And I'm Tiffany Chong.
We're also joined this evening by Marge Lam and operator Louise Croft. In the next hour, we'll bring you a closer look at the Tory government crime and punishment agenda.
And later on the show, you'll hear news about the release of an extraordinary Abbotsford prisoner, Donald Rumsfeld's next career challenge as he faces charges of war crimes, and updates on the changes inside Canadian prisons. All that and more in our news section.
And in the second half hour, we take a closer look at the history of capital punishment in Canada.
As well, you'll also be able to hear about the 2007 political prisoner calendar.
And other community announcements close to the end of the show. And we're also going to feature music tonight from the Be Good Tanya's new album called Hello Love.
Stay tuned for all that on Stark Raven in the next hour here on your community station, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The national crime rate has been on a general decline for the past 15 years. Despite this, the federal government has made its crime and punishment agenda a top priority. Justice Minister Vic Taves is pushing ahead with several drastic law and order policies. He's proposing an increase in the use of mandatory minimum sentencing for gun crimes, a three strikes and you're out law, as well as severe limits on the use of conditional sentencing. And most recently, he announced plans to have police representation in the selection process for judges. So far, none of these initiatives have become law. In addition to facing harsh criticism from the legal, grassroots, and academic communities, the minority government is having difficulty getting their bills through the House Justice Committee. Critics argue that there is no evidence to support these changes, saying the motivations are ideological. One of these critics is Jason Gradel. Jason's a Vancouver lawyer, and he's the president of the BC Civil Liberties Association. He joins us on the phone from Vancouver. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
It's my pleasure, Emily.
So Justice Minister Vic Taves has been making a lot of announcements recently. Which one of these have you found most distressing or most concerning?
Well, it's not as though there's any one of his announcements that is the most distressing. It's the general package, the ideological orientation of the justice minister that is, I think, perhaps most vexing.
And what is that ideological approach that he takes?
Well, there seems to be a sort of generalized distrust of the judiciary and judicial discretion, both in the area of sentencing, but also in the area of judicial appointments. It's a little bit surprising coming from a trained lawyer, or presumably trained lawyer, and former Attorney General of Manitoba, but it seems at this point that it's hard to draw any other conclusions.
So what kind of ideological camp does he fall in? Why is he pushing this kind of agenda, do you think?
Well, and presumably there's a minority of Canadians who feel disempowered when it comes to the justice system. There are lots of people out there who are victims of crime and, you know, quite sympathetically feel as though the system is sort of beyond their control. They see, good, hardworking taxpayers who have been wronged by somebody, see the perpetrator of a crime receive what they consider to be a too soft sentence. There are also a number of critics among the law enforcement in the law enforcement area who persistently propagandize by blaming crime rates on judiciary. These range from sort of rather cynical misstatements of the statistical facts, claiming that crime is on the rise or creating a crisis, from officers who were frustrated by cycles of crime, such as we see in the downtown East Side, where there are a number of drug addicted or FAS offenders who are repeat offenders for obvious reasons that people are familiar with. Those officers sometimes express their frustration by taking out their frustrations on the judiciary, even though obviously the judiciary doesn't necessarily have the tools to deal with mental health problems or substance abuse problems.
So I think a lot of people might agree that the justice system is alienating and frustrating and bureaucratic, or that, you know, they don't feel safe in their communities, perhaps. But I guess my question is, a lot of the proposals that the justice minister is making actually don't have a lot of evidence that they work, whereas perhaps other community-based solutions do have more evidence that they work. So why would he go against this sort of notion of actual evidence in terms of solving that problem? Seems like there's two wings out of that one problem that, you know, maybe you can agree on the problem, but do you have any comments on that?
Well, on one level, the judiciary is an easy target to use to score political points. The judiciary, of course, is limited in the extent to which it can respond publicly to complaints. All they can do is have open courtrooms and allow their processes to be scrutinized and criticized by the public. And they're not, generally speaking, inclined to voice their views on political subjects or interfere with the political process. And so, in a way, they're choosing a politically vulnerable or soft target to exploit for the purpose of gaining votes.
And so, to get into some of the specifics of what the government is proposing, one of the ideas is the three strikes and you're out bill. So what do you get three strikes for, and what does it mean when you're out?
Well, let's start at the tail end. Generally speaking, one of the most powerful designations available in criminal law is something called a dangerous offender designation. The Crown is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a person is essentially unredeemable and dangerous, or irredeemable and dangerous, and ought to be locked up indefinitely. That's approximately 300 or so dangerous offenders have been deemed in Canada, and as a consequence of that finding, a person will be locked up indefinitely until they've been rehabilitated. So that's our most serious sentence. That's, as opposed to a life sentence, which is a sort of time-limited 25-year term with a chance of parole, and the chances for parole can fluctuate depending on the circumstances. The dangerous offender designation goes quite beyond that by saying you'll be locked up until you die. There's no capital punishment in Canada, so this is effectively our harshest sentence. So that's what happens when you're out. You're out of society for good.
So how are dangerous offender designations made now?
Oh, there's a court case, essentially, after conviction for a serious crime. The the Crown brings a dangerous offender application, and ultimately, if a person is deemed to be a dangerous offender, then they're locked up indefinitely, notwithstanding whatever they were sentenced for the underlying crime.
So what changes with this three strikes and you're out, Bill?
Well, this three strikes business indicates that if you set out a number of designated offenses, and if you commit three of those designated offenses, there's a presumption that arises that you ought to be deemed to be a designated offender unless you can convince the court that you ought not be a dangerous, so deemed anyway. What are the predicate offenses? Well, they range from everything from murder to assault causing bodily harm. So what's wrong with that, you might ask? And the answer is really quite simple. There are two things wrong with it. The first thing is some of those predicate offenses aren't serious enough to warrant a dangerous offender designation. So your third offense might be something like an accused person punches somebody else in the nose and breaks their nose. Certainly not serious enough to warrant being locked up indefinitely. So we get into a situation where the type of presumption is triggered by an offense that's not serious enough. Secondly, because it's almost a freestanding designation, a dangerous offender designation, and because there's a separate punishment imposed as a consequence of that designation, it reverses the burden of proof. And this is a golden thread runs through the criminal law system, that a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and the Crown has a burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the offense is being committed. This offense effectively does away with that golden thread, severs that golden thread, and substitutes a presumption that in many cases may not be warranted.
What do you think the implications are of switching this presumption of innocence?
Well, the implication presumably is something like there'll be more dangerous offender designations, a lot more people locked up indefinitely.
And do you think that this will set a precedent for this type of change in onus?
Whether or not this will survive constitutional challenge remains to be seen. It seems to me that the proposal is quite vulnerable because that golden thread, the presumption of innocence and the Crown's burden of proof, is something that's deeply entrenched not only in our common law history, that is pre-charter, but it's also being given very prominent constitutional status, and it's one of the sacred cows of the criminal justice system. It's not easily displaced. This legislative attempt to displace it may not survive a charter challenge.
So you feel even though if the bill is passed in its current state, then, you know, it probably would not survive a constitutional challenge, although that may take many years to go through.
Yes, many, many years.
So where is that bill at in terms of the parliamentary process?
Well, to my knowledge, it hasn't passed first reading yet. At this point, some opposition party members have been making noises that the bill will be defeated at first reading, won't even make it to committee.
Okay, so that's something that you think will come in the fall legislature, or you're not sure when that bill will come forth?
It's not plain to me when it will come forth. Happily, it looks like the opposition party has decided not to bend to the, you know, these law and order agendas that became very popular in the United States, and there's an attempt to emulate some of the practices in the United States, to my mind, the three strikes legislation. That phrase was coined out of a program in California. Three felony offenses would trigger some similar kind of punishment. Minister Taves has declared that that's not where he found his inspiration, and that there's some distinguishing features that differentiate his proposal from the California scheme. But, you know, it would appear as though he... to my mind, anyway, that he's deriving some inspiration from the United States. But it appears as though the opposition parties aren't allowing that law and order agenda, that law and order mentality, to come to the fore and become the burning issue of the day. It seems as though Perhaps that work has borne fruit because of the interest, the recent poll indicating that issues like the environment are high on the public agenda, even though that might not be reflected in our current minority government agenda.
So, yeah, we have been reporting here on Stark Raven that a number of bills have faced trouble at the Justice Committee, including the one on mandatory, on conditional sentencing, and now the one on mandatory minimum sentencing, conditional sentencing as well, have been facing a lot of resistance and changes in the Justice Committee. So that might make Vic Taves think again about what kind of bills he's introducing. But one thing that he announced recently that does not actually have to go towards Parliament is their proposal for police representation on the committees that select judges. Now, this proposal has sparked outcry right up to the Supreme Court. How are judges currently selected, and what are the changes that they're proposing for this the change in the committees?
Federal judges are appointed by the caucus, essentially. The minister has the power to designate judges, to select judges, and usually does so with the advice of a panel of prominent jurists. That is, people with legal training. And there was a study recently to indicate that perhaps there ought to be lay representation on those committees. That doesn't seem like a bad idea, provided that the lay people are appropriately sort of educated in some way about who would make a good judge. And happily, that process hasn't been hugely politicized in Canada in the way it has been sort of results-oriented in the United States. Minister Taves' proposal is to add lay people, including peace officers, police officers, to that committee. The difficulty we have, of course, is the police are among the witnesses in court who are most often have their credibility placed into question, or whose credibility is at issue as a central component of court cases, not only their credibility with respect to the substantive evidence in support of a conviction, or in support of a prosecution, but also in terms of charter challenges. That is to say, the conduct of the police is very often, or the compliance of the police with charter standards, allegations of police brutality, questions about whether police gave accused people the right to counsel and so forth, are often front and center in criminal cases. So the notion that law enforcement officials whose observations and actions, choices and decisions and so forth are centrally at issues in court cases shouldn't necessarily be the best candidate for judge selection, because they might be inclined in a partisan way to select judges or urge the minister to select judges who wouldn't be critical of police actions or would tend to accept police evidence at face value without looking behind that evidence or being critical of that evidence.
So the critics are concerned about the politicization of the process, but they're also concerned about the decision making of the change in the process. Can you talk more about how that decision is going to be made and what influence people might have in terms of what the outcome of this is?
Well, it's difficult to know what the outcome of it would be, because even if that change is made, even if the composition of those committees is changed, it's not obvious, it won't be obvious to the public exactly what recommendations are made by those law enforcement officials. So it's not something that would ever come under public scrutiny. The difficulty is, aside from the potential for bias on the part of law enforcement officials who are form part of the membership of that committee. There is a tacit signal, it would seem, being sent by the Minister of Justice, which would tend to suggest that there's a political preference for the views of the law enforcement officials over the judiciary, and that's quite troubling in a way. We've always had friendly jousting as between the legislature and the executive and the judiciary in our Canadian constitutional traditions. That is to say, the legislature passes laws, the courts sometimes strike them down or modify them and send signals back to the legislature as to how they can pass laws that are charter compliant. But this is something that is sometimes referred to as the dialogue, constitutional dialogue, between the different branches of government. In a way, what the minister is talking about doing is changing that balance, changing the traditional balance that has been formed over decades and generations. And so in that way, those signals are really quite troubling, because we've seen the United States, for example, run into trouble with the balance on their balance and representation on their judiciary. Those are quite troubling signals that are being sent by the Minister of Justice.
So what's going to happen now? Because there are concerns about the lack of consultation in the process to make this decision. Is it a done deal? Or?
You know, it seems to me that we have quite an excellent judiciary in Canada. When you look around the world, lots of the other judiciaries around the world look at our judiciary with favor and with admiration. There's a lot of good, delicate, balanced, sage decision-making coming off our benches. I'm not saying that I agree with everything. As a civil libertarian, I take umbrage at many of the decisions coming out of the Supreme Court of Canada or off our Court of Appeal bench or from our superior courts in Canada. I don't like everything they do, but I can respect the tradition of reasoning, of openness, and of, generally speaking, intellectual honesty and integrity. And to the extent that there are expressions of dissatisfaction with that by the Minister of Justice, or hints that there's something wrong with the current balance, I would respectfully have to disagree with that.
Well, thanks very much for joining us this evening, Jason, and telling us a little bit more about what Vic Taves is up to.
It was my pleasure. My pleasure.
And we do keep folks updated in our news section and with other interviews, so I'd encourage people to regularly tune into Stark Raven if they want to keep updated as to what happens. And we also post some of this type of news on the website prisonjustice.ca. So we have been speaking with Jason Gradel. He's the president of the BC Civil Liberties Association. For more information, you can check out their website. It's bccla.org. And you are listening to Stark Raven here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. We're going to go now and hear some Be Good Tanyas, some of their new music here on Co-op Radio.
Just fight, sort of. Till it explodes to 1,000 tiny pieces. What's your story, universe? You are melody in numbers. You are shapes, you are rhythms. There are signs that we can learn to place over the heavens, to predict how long we'll burn, how long will I. Circling me, now my air and my flow.
It is time for the news here on Stark Raven.
A well-respected life prisoner has been granted day parole from Mountain Institution. He's been described by a BC Supreme Court judge as a unique individual with tremendous strength in character. Glenn Flett has received welcome news that he is able to leave his Agassiz prison to live in a supervised private home. Flett is a lifer who has spent much of his life assisting and counseling other prisoners. He is the co-founder of a nonprofit program called Long-Term Inmates Now in the Community, based in Abbotsford. The program organizes volunteers to provide peer support and encourage prisoners to get their lives back on track. Flett had been out of prison for about 12 years when he was arrested for driving under the influence of drugs and carrying a loaded firearm last year. His behavior was the result of several tragic events leading to an emotional breakdown. These events included the murder of two friends inside prison. Flett says he wants to return to serving the community as well as being a good husband and father.
Officials at Canada's federal prison are keeping fruit in locked storage for the holidays. Correctional Service of Canada spokesperson Jeff Campbell says that they are locking up fresh fruit to prevent prisoners from making home-brewed alcohol. Food items that are being kept under lock are oranges, apples, and bananas, as well as ketchup and bread. Campbell says he doesn't know how prisoners make homebrew.
The Correctional Service of Canada is reviewing its current policy that bans computers from prisoners' cells. The current policy allows computer use only in designated common areas under supervision. Federal prisoners were outlawed from buying or owning computers in 2003. This was the CSC's reaction to what they called a number of security breaches. The prime concern was with computer game systems that enabled file sharing and communication between computers. The current review involves investigating ways to block file sharing and access to pornography and other illicit material. About 1,100 prisoners who already had computers at the time of the policy change in 2003 were allowed to keep them with security seals and no upgrades. But that number has dwindled since then to fewer than 600. This is because prisoners are being released and equipment is breaking down. In his most recent annual report, correctional investigator Howard Sapers called for increased computer access for prisoners, both in common rooms and in personal cells. He noted the importance of computers for legal and educational purposes. Since the ban in 2003, the Office of the Correctional Investigator has been swamped with complaints about insufficient numbers of shared computers. The Correctional Service of Canada has said that the study into reintroducing personal computers inside is in its very early stages. The use of the internet is not permitted inside federal prisons.
Nunavut Premier Paul O'Callaghan is lobbying for a federal prison in the Northern Territory. O'Callaghan's plans are a reaction to the public outcry against convicted sex offender Jason Hikoaluk. Hikoaluk was placed in Iqaluit after completing his sentence for assaulting two children in Cambridge Bay. Premier O'Callaghan says that his government would have more influence over where sex offenders are placed if they had a federal prison.
The Correctional Service of Canada has issued a standardized list of personal items that prisoners may keep in prison. The list of approved items includes stringed instruments, cigarette-making machines, and cross-gender clothing. But iPods, pajamas, and ice skates are a no-no. The Correctional Service convened a special committee of security specialists to develop the list. The standardized list was created to reduce the number of grievances and financial claims filed against the CSC. In past years, more than $100,000 has been issued in compensation for personal items that have been broken or stolen in prison.
It appears that the tough-on-crime agenda is a popular one with Tory politicians. Crime and punishment has become an issue in the Tory leadership race in Alberta. All four major leadership candidates have jumped on the bandwagon. They're calling for more police and more Crown prosecutors. They also want to see changes to the Youth Criminal Justice Act. They all vowed that Alberta streets will be safer if more young people are sent to prison. Gary McPherson, he's a community and social activist, said in his experience, youngsters who go to jail come out a lot more angry and criminally savvy. It's on November 25th that the Conservative members in Alberta will vote for their next leader, who will replace Premier Ralph Klein. And we'll be back in a moment with some more news. Now we're back with some international news here on Stark Raven.
The Miami Herald is reporting the Bush administration is planning construction of a massive new mini-city at Guantanamo Bay to hold military trials for prisoners. The $125 million compound would be the largest single construction expenditure since the prison opened 4 years ago. The administration wants to begin the military commissions by July of next year. Meanwhile, a recently freed prisoner from Guantanamo Bay has come forward with allegations of torture at the hands of the U.S. military. Democracy Now! Reports that Murat Kurnaz of Turkey says he was beaten, given electric shocks, submerged in water, starved, and chained to a ceiling for several days. Kurnaz says he saw several people die and often thought he would die himself. He was held for 4 years before his release in August because of a lack of evidence against him.
Under new legislation, the Supreme Court of China will now review all death penalty verdicts in the country. It will mean that all death penalties handed down by provincial courts must be reviewed and ratified by the Supreme People's Court. Amnesty International said that this change will possibly help improve the quality of trials for those facing the death penalty in China. It may also reduce the number of executions. But even with this reform, those facing the death penalty are unlikely to receive a fair trial in line with international human rights standards. Trials in China are generally marked by a lack of prompt access to lawyers, lack of presumption of innocence, political interference in the judiciary, and the failure to exclude evidence extracted under torture. China does not release full public statistics on death sentences and executions. The death penalty remains applicable to almost 70 crimes in China. They include nonviolent offenses, such as committing tax fraud, embezzling state property, and accepting a bribe. China remains the world leader in its use of the death penalty. In 2005, almost 1,800 people were reported executed. The true numbers of those executed are believed to be much higher, closer to 10,000 people per year.
The U.S.-based Center for Constitutional Rights has filed a criminal complaint of war crimes against outgoing Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. The complaint was filed in Germany. That's because their laws on torture and war crimes permit the prosecution of suspected war criminals wherever they may be found. The complaint makes a request to the German federal prosecutor to open an investigation and ultimately a criminal prosecution. The investigation would look into the responsibility of high-ranking U.S. officials for authorizing war crimes in the name of the so-called War on Terror. The suit is being brought on behalf of a dozen torture victims. They include 11 Iraqi citizens who were held at Abu Ghraib prison and one Guantanamo detainee. The plaintiffs claim they were victims of electric shock, severe beatings, sleep and food deprivation, and sexual abuse. Current Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and former CIA Director George Tenet are also charged in the complaint.
North Korea is bristling after South Korea voiced support for a UN resolution that criticizes the North's violation of human rights. South Korea voted for a draft resolution that states the North is guilty of torture, public executions, and dismal prison conditions. The official news agency of North Korea called the southern government's action a crime which threatens relations between the neighbors. And that's the news for tonight on Stark Raven.
Revivalist, revivalist, revivalist. Oh. Well, I get so along on the ending road. I'm picking songs, I'm picking strings. If I could pick anything, it would be you. It's new faces on a Tuesday night, new faces on a Wednesday night, new faces on a Thursday night. Looking for you, fabulous. Everything that I do, fabulous. Pull me through, fabulous. Make it new, revivalist. Part I will lose.
That's right. It's the folk focus here on Stark Raven. And that was some Be Good Tanyas, the Be Good Tanyas, off their latest album, Hello Love. I just got it today, so that's the second time I've heard that song. And that was Udesenia. And earlier in the show, we heard A Thousand Tiny Pieces, and their album's called Hello Love.
And the song before that song, or no, the Be Good Tanyas song, was Ray Spoon off Ray Spoon's album, White Hearse Comes Rolling. And the track we heard was called Revivalist.
And we're going to go now to our feature on the history of capital punishment in Canada. You're listening to Stark Raven. This is Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Now, in the last couple of weeks, Canadians have been hearing about Saddam Hussein's impending death by hanging. While the noose seems like a brutal form of execution, some older Canadians might remember a time when it was the only method of execution in this country. Here's a quick history of the noose, according to Andrew Chung of the Toronto Star. Death by hanging requires precise calculations. If the rope is too long, the person's head might be pulled off. If the rope is too short, they will suffocate. The last hanging in Canada took place at Toronto's Don Jail in 1962. It was December 11th, and two prisoners were executed. They were 54-year-old Arthur Lucas and 29-year-old Ronald Turpin. Their legs were tied at the knees and ankles. White hoods were placed on their heads. Nooses were tightened around their necks. Then back to back, they fell through a trap door to their death. Outside the Don Jail, protesters marched in the bitter cold with signs that said, "Hanging is also murder, and Christmas in a grave." At that point, Canadians were already uncomfortable with the idea of capital punishment and hanging. Those two were the last to be hanged in Canada, which abolished the death penalty 14 years later in 1976. But the fact is that Canada was a hanging country. Even while the United States had embraced electrocution, believed at the time to be more humane and modern, Canada continued to hang. Even while the gas chamber came into vogue down south, Canada still hanged. According to the Department of Justice, before hanging was abolished, 710 people were executed out of 1,481 who had been sentenced to death. 13 of those were women. By the time the killing ended, discomfort with the death penalty was growing rapidly in many Western countries. The beginnings of the hanging as a method of execution began sometime in the Middle Ages. It became the primary means of execution in Britain by the 10th century. But as the years went by, with growing secularization and observations that it wasn't an effective crime deterrent, this led to the increasing sense of queasiness towards the death penalty. Penal laws also began to change, both in Britain and the colonies, and fewer crimes brought the death penalty. For instance, in Canada in 1859, death sentences were given to crimes of murder, rape, and treason, but also attempted murder, buggery, robbery, arson, and endangering a ship. By 1869, it was only murder, rape, and treason that drew the sentence of execution. And a moratorium was placed on hanging by 1976. Parliament abolished the death penalty, except for some offences under the National Defence Act, after Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau said in a speech, quote, "Those who vote against the bill cannot escape their personal share of responsibility for the hangings that will take place if the bill is defeated." Today, hanging is virtually unheard of in Western countries. In the U.S., two states still allow it, Washington and New Hampshire, although the last hanging in the U.S. took place 10 years ago. However, hanging is not uncommon in the rest of the world. According to Amnesty International, which was largely founded on the principle of fighting capital punishment for political prisoners. Hanging is practiced in places such as Egypt, Jordan, Pakistan, and Iran. But hanging isn't an option only in developing countries, dictatorships, or military oligarchies. Japan, which is an economic superpower and an established democracy governed by the rule of law, still hangs, and so too does the state of Singapore. And while Japan hangs rather infrequently, the Singaporeans have a real operating system for their hangings. So that's just a brief history of hanging and capital punishment while we think about Saddam Hussein and his future, whatever that may be.
You're listening to Stark Raven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And we have a couple announcements to go out with here on the end bit of the show. So one is, I just wanted to let folks know that the Certain Days 2007 Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar is available. The focus this year is on immigration, so it features the work of many political prisoners and their supporters, including David Gilbert, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the Move 9, the Cuban Five, and more. So it's a benefit for the New York State Task Force on Political Prisoners, known as Illegal Kingston, and a Palestinian prisoner solidarity group called Adamir. So for more information, check out certaindays.org. That's where you can find more information on the calendar and how to purchase it.
The SFU School of Communication Counterculture Series presents Palestine as a Cinematic Reel. And it's a view from within with filmmaker, writer, and scholar Sobi El-Zobaidi. And drawing on examples of filmmaking from dispersed communities, this presentation will discuss the notion of space in new Palestinian cinema to offer an insider's perspective on Palestinian relationships with space, or whatever is left for them to call space. So that's happening Thursday, November 23rd at 7 p.m. That's at SFU's downtown campus, 515 West Hastings Street in room 1600.
Upping the Ante launch party. Come and celebrate the launch of the highly anticipated third issue of Upping the Ante, a journal of theory and action. The event's going to be on Thursday evening, November 23rd. It's this Thursday, actually. It's going to go on from 7 till 10 p.m. at Rhizome Cafe, 317 East Broadway. It's just right across the street from Kingsgate Mall. And it's sliding scale, $5 to $10. And it includes a copy of the journal, which you guys should check out. No one will be turned away, so just come and listen to some really good music. There's two very, I think, very talented local DJs, DJ Shi and Sue Comandante, and they're going to be playing music, the kind of music I like, house, soul, funk, reggae, dancehall, dub, reggaeton, Latin beats, all the stuff with rhythm. And there will be drinks, dancing, and good fun with local DJs spinning some tunes. And if you don't know, Upping the Ante, a journal of theory and action, it's a grassroots publication featuring the work of activists engaged with the three interwoven tendencies which have come to define much of the politics of today's radical left: anti-capitalism, anti-oppression, and anti-imperialism. For more information about the journal and the launch, please go to auto_soul@dao.ca, auto_sol.tao.ca.
All right, well, that's it for today's show. If you're interested in keeping in touch with Stark Raven, you can join our email list. Yay! So you can email us at stark-raven@cooperadio.org. It gives you information about our upcoming shows, a digest of our recent news, and audio links. And in case you missed an episode of Stark Raven, you can catch us anytime on our podcast. That's right, you can now download any show onto your computer, MP3 player, and listen to it anytime. So to find out more about that, you can check prisonjustice.ca. We're only here the first three Mondays of each month. Tune in next week for Y57 Co-op's Radio's Youth Show. We'll be back on Monday, December 4th for the World AIDS Day special. Coming up next is Think Indian, followed by Patchback and Blues in the Dark. And we're going to go out with a track
by Feist on her Open Season Remixes and Collabs. The track is called Gatekeeper.
Have a good night, everyone. Thank you.
the sun sets in as a scene set for new lovers. You play a part, painting and start by each gate. We'll open another. July, August, said it's probably hard to plan ahead. July, August, said it's better to bask in each other. Can't keep our seasons, wait for the night. Can't keep our, you held your breath, made the summer go on, on. Rose, oh, February, April, said, don't.